Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collection, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writer Series. Tonight, I'm delighted to welcome Anca Vlasopoulos to campus for the reading. Anca Vlasopoulos' memoir, No Return Address, has just been published by Columbia University Press. The date of publication is right now, and there's the book over there. If you'd like to purchase it after the reading. She has published in Peninsula, Essays and Memories, and Memoirs by Michigan Writers, MSU Press 2000, has published a poetry collection, Through the Straits, At Large, a chapbook, The Evidence of Spring, a detective novel, Missing Members, over 200 poems in literary magazines, and has written a libretto for the opera Canu and the Magic Coals, performed by the Michigan Opera Theater, the Hilbury Theater, and the Wayne State University School of Music. Her scholarly publications include a book of literary criticism entitled The Symbolic Method of Coleridge, Baudelaire, and Yeats, and over 20 scholarly articles and book chapters on literature, theater, and film. She is professor of English and director of the Comparative Literature Program at Wayne State University. Please join me in welcoming Anca Vlasopoulos.
I've got the poetry collection and the mystery novel and my new book up here if anybody's interested, and I'm going to read a fairly long chapter that precedes the one that was published in Peninsula. I have two chapters in my book dedicated to Detroit, and it's a book that's really very much centered around cities, and Detroit is the only city that gets two chapters, more than Paris. So there you are. This one is called Misplacing Detroit. As you'll see, even though these are purportedly about a particular city, they're also about many other things as well. In order to come to America, we had to be sanitized. Not only did our relatives have to vouch for our good future good behavior and without exception guarantee financial support so we wouldn't become burdens to the state, but both in Europe and upon our arrival, we had to undergo extensive physicals lest we carry contaminants. Several times we passed the marine guarded entrance of the American Embassy in Paris to be processed by MDs who barely spoke French. One of the doctors who was of Greek origin and who expressed deep disapproval about finding that despite our last name, neither my mother nor I spoke Greek, nonetheless took time to walk me to a globe and point to Detroit nestled among all that blue. I took a quick turn back to the map of Europe, and I could see at a glance that the Great Lakes were larger than many a sea. I began to dream of a city of skyscrapers on the shores of a lake like the sea. There would be huge apartment buildings, neither the decorous old regime ones on the boulevards of Paris and Bucharest, nor the garish ones colored in nursery pastels built on Romanian vacant lots. Under the influence of a beautiful city, that is Paris, my taste in architecture was improving. These buildings would be black glass or soft gray cement. They would soar into the rainy night. I would be walking on the street along the lake, staring at the mobile circles made by raindrops on the water. There would be practically no traffic, though occasionally headlights would appear out of the dark, blind me momentarily, and metamorphose into the angry glare of brake reds. A boy my age but taller would be walking toward me. We would glance at each other, say nothing, then go our ways. Or he would sweep me into his arms and kiss me, long and passionately, both of us knowing that fate had brought us together. In sleep and wakefulness, I kept dreaming of the city by the lakeshore. Years and many disappointments later, I went to Chicago for the first time and realized that somehow my soul and my weak sense of U.S. geography, the latter the product of a communist education, had gotten lost amid the lakes. I had dreamed Chicago instead of Detroit. I wonder if my immigrant experience would have altered had I arrived in the city of my dreams. Surely other elements, the tall boy, for instance, would have failed to materialize, but it consoled me to know that I had not been utterly chimerical, that there was a city corresponding to my imaginings, that it happened not to be the city in which, on and off, I would spend my American life. When the U.S. visas came, we were in Belgium, and they came for my mother and me only. Panicked, my stepfather began making extravagant promises and abject apologies for past behavior, so my mother would not leave without him. My mother told him she would stay for the time during which the visas remained valid, 2 months. After that, she would expect him to join us in the United States. His visa came during the following month. My bad luck always, she would lament almost daily for the last 2 years of the marriage and occasionally afterwards, when something traumatic or an encounter with a Romanian acquaintance made the memory of her ex-husband surface once more. For she remained convinced that he wouldn't have had the initiative to make the ocean crossing on his own. thus the three of us left together for America. By the early 60s, the vast majority of immigrants to the States were taking planes, but I lobbied with great passion for a boat passage, and my mother found out that the medical dispensation would convince the Jewish charity that loaned us the money for the crossing to let us take a boat instead of a plane. My stepfather, for once, came in handy. He had excessively high blood pressure. In medieval times, he would have been classified as choleric. Together, he and my mother visited a cardiologist in Dusseldorf Hospital to obtain professional opinion that flying would be bad for Dick's health. As they stood in the hallway chatting, the doctor noticed his patients in the heart disease ward were also chatting softly. He ordered them to be silent. He returned to his conversation in the hallway, and the patients once more began to make soft background noises. "They're supposed to rest," he bellowed, then added, addressing himself to my mother, "If only I had a machine gun, I'd go in there and have quiet once for all." My mother had braved and heavily bribed the Romanian customs officials to let her hide my bear, my oldest and most beloved stuffed toy I owned, in the bottom of the 120-pound trunk that was to carry all our permitted earthly possessions into the West. In Germany, she faced this man, yet another doctor with a final solution, to get the certificate that would provide me, though I didn't know it at the time, with a quintessential, if a bit dated, immigrant arrival in the New World. I love the ocean crossing. Europe was in the grip of a ferocious winter, even in temperate Holland, where we embarked on the ship bearing the same name as the port, Rotterdam. And an equally dismal February would stretch before us in Detroit, but in the mid-Atlantic rolled in springtime. The balmy sea breeze of the Gulf Stream gave us sunny days and hazy, mild weather. Gulls followed the wake, eating the garbage discarded by the ship and resting on the mast at night. Dolphins frolicked alongside. We shed our coats and strolled out on the deck in light jackets, letting the soft, salt-laden wind blow on our sallow winter faces. I love the luxury of being waited on and fed every 3 hours like a baby. I love the ship's library, a large, quiet room where I chanced on a collection of romans noirs with the arched back black cat trademark on the cheap bindings. I began reading Babbitt in French and understood little of its untranslatable Americanisms. In the library, I met an unprepossessing young man who kept paper napkins about him into which to blow his nose, and a somewhat older French naval officer. They both showed some interest in me, the first chiding me for ruining my mind by reading mystery novels. He proposed to loan me his set of Gorky instead, and I laughed in his face, telling him that I'd had enough of Russian literature forever. In about 3 years, I would be writing my high school research paper on Dostoevsky, but certainly not because this unkempt person who'd picked up communist leanings in his sojourn in France the way others develop a taste for Camembert, and who, despite knowing of my circumstances, insisted on trying to convert me to the very dogma I had so happily left behind. The French officer, uninterested in reading of any kind, asked me if I played chess. There were several sets set out on the chess tables in the library. The chess set we owned in Bucharest had been made of wood. The whites were unstained but polished, ranging in color from ivory to deep beige, and the black pieces were light mahogany. Respectively, they are rather like the people that call themselves white and black in my American city. The brown bishop lost his head at one point, and my father sought out a carpenter who could replace it. Private carpenters had so little access to the materials of their trade that the man had to leave the wood in its natural state so that the poor bishop sported an incongruous matte cedar gray head on his glossy body. Ever since I was little, I had been fascinated by chess. I would hover around the board or sit on the floor in silence as my father and one or another of his friends, always a man, stared motionless at the checkerboard. To my father's irritated amusement, I would demand a matching piece. "I have 3 brown pieces. Let me have 3 white," not understanding that I was asking for my father's loss. But it didn't matter what I wanted because he always won. He had been a chess champion in his youth, and even now his invulnerability exasperated his friends. Once in a while, after a friend had left rather abruptly, refusing the proffered preserves, my mother would suggest to my father, "Why don't you let him win once?" While my father laughed at the outlandish notion of faking incompetence. Even when he taught me to play in my 5th year, he would never condescend to let me win, despite my mother's pleas. "When she's good enough, she'll beat me, and that will be a true victory," he said. But of course, I had no chance to become good enough in the time left us. Yet I did get so good that I won most of the games against my friends and schoolmates. All my chess partners were boys. My friends, accustomed to thinking of me as one of the gang, were no more irritated by my being a girl and beating them than by the simple fact of my winning. But my schoolmates had a harder time taking defeat for someone who looked like easy prey. As a result, I enjoyed beating them all the more. My French lieutenant, I realized retrospectively, wanted to use the medium of chess to flirt, but I, not fancying myself an object of desire to a man his age and intensely interested in the game, concentrated wholly on chess. I beat him. He was upset to a degree that almost frightened me. He demanded a rematch, but was called away, not before exacting my promise, not once but three times, that we would play again. That night, our fifth on board, the Rotterdam was a slow boat. We must have crossed into currents from the icy coast of North America because the balmy weather changed to a storm. The crew immediately equipped all stairwells and hallways with ropes on which people could steady themselves as the boat lurched and pitched. The next morning, the breakfast ranks were much thinned. Even my stepfather had no stomach for meals. I reveled in the storm and spent as much time as I could on deck, watching the prow alternately plunge for a heart-arresting moment into the gray waters right toward the bottom of the sea, then rise so high that the whole ship leaped heavenward, defying gravity. I would come back to the lounge half-wet, smelling of algae and salt. I would eagerly accept the bouillon, crackers, or the tomato juice offered by waiters in white dinner jackets, who were able to anticipate the movement of the ship and miraculously maintain equilibrium when being buoyed toward the ceiling or sucked into the floor without spilling a drop on the crisp linen that covered their trays. At one point on that first morning of the storm, the French officer spotted me and challenged me to the rematch. I accepted somewhat reluctantly since the sensation of the storm was still new upon me and I would have preferred to return to the deck. We sat to play. This time I could see he was in earnest. The time between moves grew longer. I began to erect the impenetrable defenses that my adversaries found so unnerving that inevitably they would commit an error, at which point I would deliberately begin to break through their own weak defenses. Years later, when I played chess with my husband, I found the first male player who had the same basic strategy, and I was stymied. Our games took hours, days, with each of us so reluctant to dismantle any of our defenses that neither of us attacked. I would win ultimately, but it took much longer and gave me a clue about our uncanny compatibility. The man I was playing on the Rotterdam, however, fell for the offensive strategy. Just as I saw my opening and made my first threatening move, he stopped the waiter. "I have to take something," he said to me. "This up and down motion is terrible." "Take the crackers," I advised, having read books about seasickness and speaking without any feeling for his distress. "The bouillon liquids in general are no good." He gave me a baleful look and drank a cup of soup. Then he moved, making yet another more devastating error. "Are you sure you feel good enough to go on?" I asked. He waved my question aside, but I saw his thin face take on a greenish tinge. I checked him. He looked at the board, then at me. In two moves, I would checkmate. He struggled to get his handkerchief out of his pocket and brought it abruptly to his lips. I saw him go through a spasm of nausea and again motion to me in a gesture between apology and dismissal, then run down the hall. After that, I saw little of him, and he never asked to finish his rematch. As we approached New York Harbor, the weather grew cold and gray. Even as I felt my extremities go numb, I was loath to leave the deck, my restlessness mounting as we came closer to land. America, after all, had been my idea. My mother had given in to my desire only after being warned off by relatives in Israel and seeing that the governments of Western Europe were most reluctant to let us take up permanent residence. The morning of our scheduled landing, I gazed about me and started jumping up and down with glee when I spotted the Statue of Liberty, a darker gray but unmistakable silhouette with a torch taking shape like an optical illusion amid the gray light enveloping us. People in the lounge saw me shouting and pointing, and they came out too to take a look. "I was the first to see it," I kept saying, "the first." As we floated so close to the New Jersey coast that store signs became visible, I was struck by the frequent appearance of a word that I thought I could fathom, one among the treacherous faux amis that would lead me into error for some years to come. In large, generally red letters, liquor. "Liqueur," I mused. And already I felt that I would meet with strange obsessions in this new land. After the customs officials processed us, asking in a familiar refrain, "Are you or have you ever been?" we found ourselves in a huge warehouse of the New Jersey port. A man with a tag of some kind approached us, identified himself as a member of the Jewish Federation, and said he would be escorting us to the train that would take us to Detroit. He communicated with my mother, the only one of us who spoke English, although she found spoken American English almost unintelligible. "We don't get to spend even a night in New York," I nearly wailed. The man seemed huge, brisk, jovial, conforming to the stereotype that we had brought with us over the ocean. He drove us through tunnels and over bridges, too fast, I thought, since I was eager not to miss anything. In the tangle of Manhattan, he had to slow down, and I gasped with wonder and joy at the skyscrapers, the promised metropolis with its crowds and glittering windows and animated advertisements. Over what must have been Broadway hung a billboard with a mouth outlined in lipstick and a cigarette. The mouth closed on it, then let go, and a puff of smoke emerged. I was filled with enchantment, with a buoyancy that made me much like that which had thrust the ship into the sky beyond the reach of gravity. Even now, when I revisit Manhattan, something of that delighted wonder returns, and I walk the island tirelessly, happy to be released to the rhythms of my own locomotion from the automated prison in which I traverse my hometown, Motown. The train that took us to Detroit, which sometime in the late 60s stopped service so that now to get to New York from Detroit, one must travel to Chicago 400 miles in the wrong direction, was elegant, but that was nothing new to us. In the dining car, we had our first typical American meal of steak and baked potato and iceberg lettuce with Thousand Island dressing. Everything, most of all the salad, which I had never had before, tasted exotic. And I savored the crunch of the bland leaves, the strange sweetness of the dressing, the way in later years I would sample the peculiar blend of banana and lime that makes up the flavor of kiwi, or the slight sting underneath the slimy sweet flesh of a mango. I willed myself to like it as I would will myself to like so many other things that offended my palate or my soul in years to come, until something inside me would rebel and say, "Enough," curiously, always in my mother's voice. For years now, I've refused to buy iceberg lettuce, and I only had Thousand Island dressing two more times before deciding I could not like that preposterous mix of tastes. From the train window, and then from the window of my great uncle's car, the first sights of Detroit smote my heart. We arrived at the glorious Art Deco terminal, now boarded up for at least two decades, and saw no one on the platform waiting for us. Bewildered, we walked to the end and discovered that people were not allowed to wait for the passengers right on the platforms. My mother's aunts stood behind a rope, waving their handkerchiefs, applying them to their eyes. My mother's aunts and her uncle by marriage were not stereotypically American. They were tiny. My married aunt was dressed in black with a little hat trailing a vestige of veil. My unmarried aunt wore a bright royal blue coat with a fur collar and earrings with red stones. Later, my mother said, "I knew right away which was which. Teresa, the sensible one, dressed as befits her age, and Golda, always inappropriately." Maybe because in a household of six girls, she was the only one who was said to be just pretty. The others were all beauties. My great uncle spoke no Romanian, though he remembered enough Yiddish to be able to exchange some words with Dick. My mother was, of course, immediately immersed in a flood of conversation with her aunts, especially as Teresa, when my mother asked about her two daughters, revealed for the first time that the younger had died 2 years before our arrival. What was it in my mother's family, on both the maternal and paternal sides, that forced this reticence about death as if it were obscene somehow? On her father's side, where the males were Kohanim, descendants through patrimony from the high priests of Israel forbidden to look on death, there was perhaps a shrinking to which they held as part of their genetic status as the only Jewish aristocracy. But here they were, all that was left of my mother's maternal side, except perhaps for the sister in Russia, from whom no one had heard in a long time, commoners all, with a familiar shame about having to speak of death. I saw my uncle, who understood only a few words of Romanian despite being exposed to it for over 40 years in the private discourse of his wife and her sister, look sharply as he heard the name of his dead daughter, and then saw his wiry frame shaken by a brief sob. I began to love him at that moment. How different that naked, sudden pang from my stepfather's elaborate preparation for grief, audibly revving up the motor of his emotions to the weeping point with a flood of words. We piled into my great-uncle's unsafe at any speed Corvair, for a time my ideal car because he drove one, and wended our way through the snowy city. City, I asked myself, feeling the whole fatigue of the journey sinking into the pit of my stomach. This was the small town against which I had been warned by all my reading of 19th century French novels, and more recently by Babbitt. It was a deserted provincial backwater that my physician uncle, who had never presumed to advise me about anything except germs, had brought to warn himself against. In one of the few moments we had alone in the feverish rush of our last days in Bucharest, he said, "Don't get stuck in Detroit. Go to New York, the center, where you'll find scope." I wasn't quite sure what he meant and didn't think much about it, since all I dreamed about was severing myself from sick old Europe. But his words came back to me as I was forced to juxtapose the life and lights of Manhattan with a snowbound, empty landscape along which we were driving. The view was incontrovertibly ugly, with unhandsome little houses on desolate streets and main thoroughfares on which all the buildings looked flat, as if a plane had flown too low and its wings had raised the roofs on both sides. Their shabby, cardboard-looking facades looked like a theater set of a makeshift settlement in the middle of a vast plain. Only rarely, when I'm in a particularly foul mood, can I recapture, as I drive down one of Detroit's main arteries, the aesthetic shock that benumbed me on my first ride through the city that would become my mental location for the remainder of my American life. But I had not yet discovered downtown. For the first 3 weeks, we stayed at my great-aunt's house in a neighborhood that had already changed, as people obliquely put it. Used to bodily freedom and now packed in the downstairs flat, we used every opportunity to take walks to the amusement and alarm of our hosts. My great-uncle kindly offered to drive us wherever we wanted to go, but we didn't want to go anywhere, we just wanted to go out. My aunt would shake her head and say something in English to her husband, probably to the effect that he should let us learn from our mistakes or that we should be given time to shed our European habits. Both she and her inappropriate sister remained slightly ashamed of us, as some families are of their mentally deficient children, especially after my mother's divorce. Whenever my mother indicated to her aunt that she had found American ways retrograde, Teresa would dismiss her increasingly frequent and vehement critiques with stock phrases, no doubt inscribed on her own immigrant consciousness when she came to Detroit 40 years before. Don't act like you just got off the boat. Don't be such a greenhorn. The first of these confrontations came early on within the 3 weeks of our stay in that house. The man who had been an informer for the Jewish charity in Paris, whom my stepfather had known in Romania, came to visit us. I think he was trying to establish relations with all the recently arrived families in order to spread his network that spied and reported on all who had gotten what job and didn't immediately declare it, whose relatives had bought them what stick of furniture that the Jewish Federation would not have to fund. He heard from my great aunt about our penchant for perambulations, and no longer a greenhorn himself, he warned us that we should give up our wallets if a colored man with a knife approached us. Remember, this is the 60s. Since he spoke Romanian, I understood him, whereas such euphemisms as changing remained incomprehensible for me for some time. I had never liked the man, couldn't wait for him to go, so I could ask my mother whether she thought the same as I did, that only scum like him were racist, that all the stuff about whites and blacks hating each other was just communist propaganda. Communist propaganda, my mother echoed, astonishment in her voice. Is that what you thought? Didn't you know why I didn't want to come here? Didn't you see all the newsreels of police beating Negroes? The ground seemed to open before me. I had spent my childhood decoding and hearing adults decode the lies in the official news. Now, suddenly, what I had regarded as the crasses of anti-Americanism turned out to be real. I thought they faked the newsreels, I said lamely. Look around you, my mother said. Your aunt and uncle can't wait to move out of this neighborhood. Their neighbors are kind, educated people, but they're not white. I couldn't fail to notice that my mother had already begun the process of detaching herself from the only people on whom she might have had any claims on this vast continent. They had suddenly become my relatives, not hers. From our first days in Detroit to my mother's last, much of our talk revolved around the insoluble. Why? I would ask about racial hatred. There's no why, my mother would reply, and would remind me of the joke about the cyclists and the Jews. It goes like this. Did you know the cyclists and Jews started World War I? The common, all too common response is, why the cyclists? The teller then asks, why the Jews? But she proceeded to alienate herself from various circles of people her age and older by her insistence on honesty about race relations. First, my great aunts gave up on her, calling her a red, asking her if she hadn't learned anything from her suffering since they labeled all civil rights fighters as communists. My mother would occasionally explode and tell them about the absurdity of a persecuted minority finding its place by persecuting other more visible minorities. Embarrassed by our views and our readiness to express them, our relatives kept us from meeting their friends and relations and treated us as primitives. The last time we saw our American relatives, they were about to move to Kentucky to be close to their remaining daughter, who had just married a rich appliance store owner, painstakingly guarded from meeting my mother till the day of the wedding. Could they have thought that anyone interested in my exceedingly elegant, insipid cousin would be derailed from the course of true love by my mother? Were they motivated once more by the fear in their ranks was a thinking, speaking, passionate woman whose daughter had also not learned to govern her tongue? At any rate, Our first intimations that our cousin was about to make a second marriage were invitations to her wedding. Soon after, my great-aunt began spending my uncle's fixed income on several long-distance calls a day, timed when my cousin's husband was away so that she and her daughter could anatomize each word and gesture of the new marriage as they had done the old without a moment's reflection that no union can bear such intense scrutiny. In order to make sure that her daughter would find a refuge from marital discord should any arise, my great-aunt decided that she and her husband and her sister would move to Louisville and set up house together for the first time. Whenever my mother and I chanced upon my great-uncle alone, he would entertain us with stories about his eccentric sister-in-law that made us laugh ourselves silly, but covered up the great bitterness of his marriage, the constant lack of privacy and harmony that my great-aunt Golda's daily visits had cost him. This planned move to an unknown city, though they were in their 70s, and the prospect of spending his last years in the unrelieved company of his sister-in-law made him visibly unhappy, but he had always honored his wife, and his respect for her made him unable to oppose her. My mother and I arrived for our leave-taking and to collect a cardboard wardrobe that my great-aunt had decided to bestow on us, as she had generally discarded other furniture that did not fit into the suburban house to which they had moved from their changed Detroit neighborhood. I hated the furniture, which followed us only so far as the hamlet up north where my mother and stepfather got their first teaching jobs. I hated its Victorian heaviness, its dark colors, its ornateness. I chafed at having to lift all 8 of the chairs to vacuum under them. Only the credenza came back to Detroit with us. Objectively speaking, it is a lovely piece of old furniture, admired by my sister-in-law and left to her by my mother, now refinished in a lighter stain and standing in the foyer of her home. To all that, I had always wished good riddance. My eye lusting for the irregular angles of the salt and pepper couch designed by my great aunt's son-in-law, an interior designer who had had the misfortune to marry the cousin who died. From all accounts, especially those of our great aunt Golda's displeasure with his cousin, she was the one whose tastes we would have liked. It so chanced that relatives of my great uncle came to say goodbye at the same time as we. In the 4 years in and around Detroit, we had never met these people. As we conversed, we found that the man worked in the production department of the local public television station, and my mother turned an inquiring look on my great aunt, who had known my mother's passion and trade were film editing, and yet had failed to connect her with this man of high position in the same profession because, she had insisted when we first came, my mother ought to start from the bottom like everyone else. To my aunt's annoyance, my mother declared that at 45 she had no time to start from anywhere but a professional level and refused the job as a cook's assistant in a home for the aged. She took the few documents that she arranged to smuggle out of Romania to be evaluated by the Board of Education in Lansing, and she reluctantly returned to what had been her pre-war career, teaching. My great aunts took my mother's modest successes an affront, the greenhorn making good despite the conventional wisdom they had dispensed. Now, as the conversation meandered from jobs to politics, my mother and I, for the first time, found common ground with people in my great aunt's house. The unknown relatives expressed the same opinions about race. When Golda said something about the colored and their ignorant ways, my uncle's nephew retorted, "Yes, and yet some highly educated people who appreciated Beethoven and Goethe sent our people to the gas chambers." In the meantime, Teresa tried to keep a neutral face. She served them, and couldn't avoid serving us, a chocolate torte of fine quality. "Where did you get this?" I asked, mindful not to scrape my plate too obviously, and much surprised because all we had been served at their house were store-bought sweets. "Teresa's famous in the family for her chocolate cake," my uncle's nephew said, at which my mother couldn't help but give a wan smile. I had never known my great aunt to bake anything, let alone something this delicious, but she undoubtedly judged that either we were not worthy of her labor or our palates were not fine enough to relish her specialty. My great uncle's relatives left shortly after the cake was served, not before making it clear that they thought the move to Kentucky a grave mistake. I don't know what triggered the next events, for they seemed to happen at once like an electric short circuit. Whether their own American relatives' disapproval of their views and alliance with ours had made our aunts feel once more out of step with the society into which they had tried so hard to fit, or whether they were saving all this up for one last time, I find it impossible to tell. The moment their other visitors were out the door, Golda and Teresa began their attack. They charged my mother with all sorts of crimes from bringing me up as a gypsy who wore neither girdle nor lipstick and argued with boys and was never going to marry, to deep ingratitude toward them who had sacrificed everything to bring her here. The litany of wrongs went on and on, while my mother, stunned, tried to defend herself, and I, stung by the strap set for her to build them a few home truths. My poor uncle, who had developed great affection for me and my mother and me, ran to the kitchen and fetched me to help him with a cardboard wardrobe out of the basement. "Forget the wardrobe," I said. "I will not," my mother said, jumping up, and we were off, struggling to put the wardrobe on top of my mother's Valiant and tie it with rope. My great uncle furtively wiping tears away, I sobbing openly, my mother pale with anger. "Try not to let them get to you," my mother said as she hugged her uncle goodbye. And we drove off, never to see any of them again, since my grandmother's sisters made sure to write the last letter to my mother instructing her not to visit them in Louisville on our way to Florida, where we were planning a vacation. As I learned on that journey, my great aunt's move south might have actually helped them situate themselves more firmly within the American context. For in that brief time of the late 60s, it had become unfashionable in the North and East to express racist views, and dupes like me thought the change would be irreversible. But I was awake enough to see as we traveled down to Florida before Interstate 75 was completed that, unlike Detroit, where black people held government posts and even supervisory positions in stores and hospitals, in the South there was still the divide between clean and dirty jobs along the color line. The Dixie flag bumper stickers all through Kentucky and the Wallace billboards in Tennessee and Georgia proclaiming white supremacy 5 years before the 1972 primaries that made the governor of Alabama the great spoiler, made me afraid, as if we were traveling through a foreign country. Those feelings were compounded by my mother's inability to understand Southern speech and by Southerners' inability to understand her, which I took as a sign of her profound antipathy toward them and theirs toward her as a foreigner, since in our motel in St. Augustine, my mother had no trouble chatting at length with a maid, who was Southern too, but black. By that time, I had become so jumpy and ultra-sensitized to matters of race that I could hardly behave rationally, and I worried that my mother's chumminess may appear patronizing, especially when she spent half a day looking for presents to leave for the woman's two children. Not for the first or last time, paralyzed by shyness, I misjudged the spontaneity of feelings between the two women, for on our last day, Marcy came with a present for us. She and my mother had thought of each other, not of themselves as ideological symbols. A short time before my mother's death, she once more went over her desires as to the disposition of her body. "Don't let me be buried here," she said. "I've never got used to this country." I would, of course, engage in futile arguments with her about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. My mother said, "There's one thing I cannot get beyond. This country has made me a racist." "You," I exclaimed. "Yes," she said. Then she reminded me of the episode in which a young black man had driven his car at her in a murderous manner, run out of it wearing a stocking over his face, snatched her purse, and driven away. "I'll not get over it," she said. "Now I'm afraid when I see a group of young blacks at the mall. I never used to think like this, but that's what comes of over 20 years of hearing little else than black and white, black and white. You begin to see things that way." "But," I protested, "you'd be afraid of skinheads too if you saw a group of them at the mall." "Yes," my mother admitted, "but people like that really hurt me. What's anybody black done to me? One man scared me and took my cash and caused me a lot of inconvenience, and look how it made me generalize. And I hate it, and I don't want to think that I'll be stuck here forever in any shape or form." As usual, I was frightened by my mother's honesty. It led me to think back to how I perceived people when I first came and to contemplate how I have changed. I remember being asked when I first went to Northern High School, the only school in Detroit to offer classes for immigrant students, "Are there a lot of colored at the school?" and being unable to answer. I tried to visualize the people in the hallways. I knew my classmates were Italian, Cuban, French, Haitian, Greek, and I classified them according to whether I could speak with them. But all the other students were American, the people with whom I could not communicate except through the most inane phrases, "How are you?" "Fine," and by gestures. I knew the neighborhood where we rented an upper flat was white because my great aunt, who called classified ad numbers for us, would cross out the ads and say, "No, colors," which incensed my mother. "How can you tell, and what difference does it make? By the way they talk," my great aunt would say, smiling at our naivete, "and you can't rent from coloreds." But the people on the buses I had just begun to use, the people in the Wrigley and the A&P supermarkets at the diagonal intersection of Grand River and Oakman Boulevard, were they white or black? All I remember is that they dressed differently. Shockingly, the women wore curlers in their hair. The children chewed gum, which my mother did not allow me to do in public. They were American, and I was not. I do remember, however, that as soon as I learned a little English, my teacher had me assigned to two regular classes at Northern High, and that both my teachers were black. One was an easygoing man who taught world history. It was an easy subject for me. Even in my linguistic and cultural haze, I could see why. The world we were studying was mostly Europe and its dreary record of wars, subjects over which I had gone so many times before, the scars of which I had seen and lived with all my 14 years. Why would these students who smiled a great deal, did unthinkable things like combing their hair and applying makeup in class, and lived here across the Atlantic Divide, care about what my great uncle called the old country? The teacher was young and still eager, and he made me horribly uncomfortable by holding me up as an example whenever I got a perfect score on a quiz. But he was truly kind to all of us, helping one girl get out of a difficulty with another teacher, keeping me a few minutes after class to enunciate for me the difference between ear and year to which I had been deaf. The other teacher was an older bald man who taught art. Northern High had just refurbished its art room, and at the end of every class, he went through the ritual drill during which we all ran around cleaning and scouring and putting things away while he shouted from his desk, "I want you to show them. We're going to show them. They won't look at my room and say, 'Those Negro kids, it's no use spending money on them. They break everything. They dirty everything. This room's going to sparkle. I'm not going to have them use this room to point to and say, 'What's the use of getting them nice things? They're like animals. They'll just destroy them.'" I had trouble understanding everything he said, just as I had trouble following his directions for classwork. He took pleasure in intimidating me, which was not hard to do in those days, so after the first few times he mocked me for not understanding him, I gave up asking him to explain. I remember doing nearly everything wrong in that class, even when I thought I did all right, as when I drew a pencil sketch of a little girl in heavy winter clothing going uphill against the wind. He looked at it displeased and said, "Where is this? It's nowhere. I don't have a sense of where this is." But I also saw in his class young black men who bore themselves differently from the many kids I saw in the hallways, with a quiet dignity, a seriousness of purpose in their work that I did not often see among the other boys with their slicked hair and goofy ways. For it was the young men, not the girls, who heard this teacher's call clearly and distinctly. And for many years, when I talked about my former art teacher, I would tell only the good half of the story, his success, not my humiliation. So, whatever you name, and I confess I've forgotten the names of my Detroit teachers as I have the last names of all my international classmates at Northern High, I now break my silence because, though I did not always understand you, I sometimes did. In your wounded strength, you needed me, my white skin, so you could enact your revolt against the oppressors to the one at hand, the figure for all those you could not reach. You saw in me not the bewildered, displaced child, but the European invader who, with half an effort, would have more of a chance at the American dream than the young people you tough loved. Americans, if not by choice, at least by 400 years birthright. And I, who in my childish need to keep my heroes and villains unmixed, preserved for all those years only the righteousness of your fury. Now, more than 30 years later, I too see in black and white. There are moments when I catch and shame myself, but there are others when I cherish my perception. Several times in the last 10 years, I traveled to places that were represented in the media as the ideal American cities, Tempe, Seattle, and to others, back in sick old Europe, where there are more people of color now than at the time of my first sojourn, though not nearly as many as in my hometown. I remember landing from Seattle to Detroit's Metro Airport and seeing a mass of faces of hues different enough from what we call white to be classified as partly African in origin. I remember the feeling of homecoming. I was back. When at the Munich airport on what I vowed was my last trip to Germany, I was greeted on the plane by the African-American flight attendants who were to remain on board all the way to Detroit. I felt home again in an unprompted, spontaneous movement of the mind. I want my ashes scattered here on the Detroit River or at the foot of a newly planted tree overlooking these straits on whose borders we are still learning to live. There is no escape from what we become, only consciousness, as long as we keep it, of what we are. And I know what my mother also knew, that only in death could she rest at ease in Israel, because in her life, her fierce consciousness would not have let her be at peace with that country and herself. Anyone has questions or comments?
When did you arrive in Detroit?
in 1964, February 64, yes. Yes, Northern High School, yes. No, it was the only one that had what we would call now an ESL program, which they did not have at the time. I was. Pardon? Yes, I did. Ah. Yes, I had to take two buses to get to Northern High. The bus down Grand River and then the Joy Road transfer. I call it, to my horror, this is one secret that I wanted to keep. And I changed the name of the town and I called it Harrisville, only to realize that there is a Harrisville, Michigan. And that, you know, if those people ever find out about this, they'd be much surprised. You know, it's like these other memoirs where people say, oh, I went to the town and talked to the people and such never happened here. That's because sometimes memoirs change names to protect the innocent. But it was a very, very small town, sort of a one gas station, one dairy bar town in the Thumb area of Michigan, close to Carroll. Smaller than Carroll. This was very easy. This is probably the easiest writing that I've ever done in my life, and I think it's because I've been thinking about these things for a long time, and it just came out. What the book took me about less than a year to write, which is, you know, which is pretty short time considering that I was also, you know, doing other of my work at the same time. I had very little time off for it, but it was almost obsessive, basically, and so it came out in great gushes, much more so than others. Of course, there's always the editing, as you know, being a writer. But
when was that written?
I think I finished it in I think 94, and it took all this time to find an agent, to find a publisher, to have it in print. So when I start the book and I say I'm in my mid-40s, that's actually how old I was when I began the book, not how old I am now. Occasionally, but I didn't base any of this on journals. When I left Romania, we weren't allowed to take any scrap of written material out of the country. So whatever I did, I started afterwards. And even then, once you have your writing confiscated and destroyed, you really try to keep as much as you can in your head, because you figure that you can carry with you as long as they'll let you. The rest of the stuff is ephemeral. It's something that can be taken away from you.
How did you feel?
I was sorry that my mother was no longer alive to see what had happened. She had died 2 months early. And maybe for the younger people, I should explain what that reference is to, right? The fall of the Berlin Wall, which is the end of the what used to be called the Iron Curtain between the communist bloc and Western Europe. Well, actually, this is the chapter that precedes the one that was published in Peninsula. In Peninsula, it's the second half of Detroit. It's called Where All the Lights Were Bright, and it's my discovery of downtown and my reconciliation with the city that I found so absolutely unbearable when I first came. And they're both in the book, in No Return Address. I'm reading from the uncorrected proof of that book, because it's really pretty much the same way almost exactly the same way that the book is. We had very little editing to do on it, and I didn't want to break the binding of one of the nice new books that I just got last week. It wasn't the original title. I was asked to think of a different title by Columbia University Press. It was originally called Oral Transgressions because it has to do with prohibitions about food and speech and desires about food and speech. And that's another. That and the Axis of the Great Cities are organizing principles of the book. But Columbia said Oral Transgressions. Sounds like a dentistry manual or, you know, those during Clinton's troubles, so maybe people pick it up for the different reasons. So I said, all right, let me think of a different title. So I came up with No Return Address, which, you know, I thought fit the particular condition. Yes. It's not that I wanted to. I felt obligated to show the positive side. It's just that there were two sides, basically. And so, after writing "Misplacing Detroit," I wrote "Where All the Lights Were Bright." And they followed each other in a very nice sequence. As I said, this book was effortless. I wish other writing of mine would be as effortless.
Did the library become
human?
Did the library?
Yes. Yes, yes. I love libraries. The part of the reason for this is that in Romania, we had libraries, but we weren't allowed to take books out. So you went to the library and read the book there and left it there. Any written material was considered dangerous. And I think we all know this from various histories. Women are forbidden to learn to read. Slaves were forbidden to learn to read. The written word is very potent. So the communist regime didn't want people taking books out and possibly duplicating certain inflammatory passages because, I mean, even classical literature has these. So we were to leave the books there. And one of the great, wonderful things that I found when I came to the United States, to the West, was that you could actually take these things home and take, you know, your time reading them, and you could sit comfortably and so on. So I've always loved libraries. I started writing when I was very young. I think I was about 7 or 8 when I started writing a little bit of poetry. I liked to hear the rhythm of sentences in my head. I would write them down. And I live with very tolerant people who would gush over this. And, of course, they only encouraged me. None. Alas, a closed chapter. I doubt it.
A couple of questions that are really quite related. How has the writing of your memoir changed you as a writer?
Ah, that's very interesting. One of the things that I see as a writer and a person is that I'm no longer the person who wrote this book. And that's the amazing thing when you write a memoir. You think, oh, well, these are my opinions. This is how I feel. But, you know, you get 6 years older and you get more distant from those feelings and you say, this is a different person. And it's not that I disavow anything that I've said in the book, but I feel differently now. And my life is different. So what can I say? It teaches me who I was. I really was afraid. You know, as you said, the Christmas 1989, a whole world has vanished. And this world really contained the people that I grew up with, my parents and other people. And that's the communist bloc regime. And that's gone. Whatever shape it's in now, whether it's for better or for worse, it's not what it used to be. And I thought, other people are writing about it, they're writing essays and so on, they don't correspond to the way that I remember things, and I wanted to capture that before it was gone from my mind as well. That was really an impetus. It's so easy to forget and distort history. Thanks.